stories, of course. One is always hearing stories about men of his type.
Yes, said Balfour. What do I know about Carver?
Lerventhal mused, turning the question over in his mind.
Well, I know that he's got roots in Hong Kong. His father was a financier of some kind, something to do with merchant trading. But he and his father must have parted ways, because he is not associated with the parent firm any longer. He is a lone agent, is he not? A trader. Perhaps he and his father parted ways after he was convicted.
But what do you make of him? Balfour pressed.
I suppose that my impression of him is not an altogether good one. He is a rich man's son first, and a convict second, but it might just as well be the other way about. I believe he shows the worst of both worlds. He's a thug, but he's conniving. Or, to put it another way, his life is lavish, but it's base.
This character summation was a quintessential one for Benjamin Lerventhal, who, in his thinking, tended always to position himself as the elucidating third party between opposing forces. In his evaluations of other men, Lerventhal first identified an essential disparity in their person, and then explained how the poles of this disparity could only be synthesized in theory and by Lerventhal himself. He was fated to see the inherent duality in all things, even in his own appraisal of the duality of all things, and was obliged, as a consequence, to adopt a strict personal code of categorical imperatives, as a protective measure against what he perceived to be a world of discrepancy and flux. This personal code was phlegmatic, reflexive, and highly principled. It was the only fixed seat from which he could regard these never-ending dualities, and he depended upon it wholly. He tended to be relaxed in his daily schedule, humorous in his religion, and flexible in his business, but upon his imperatives he could not be mistaken, and he would not yield.
"Carver got me in a touch of hot water recently," he went on. "Around a fortnight ago, he left his mooring off schedule, and in the middle of the night. Well, it was a Sunday, and so the shipping news had been published already in Saturday's edition. But because Godspeed wasn't scheduled to leave that day, and because she left well after sundown, somehow her departure wasn't recorded in the custom house log. Well, nobody told me anything about it, and so her departure was never recorded in the paper either. Quite as if the ship never left her mooring. The harbour master was very upset about it."
"Last Sunday," said Balfour.
"That's the day Lauderback arrived."
"I suppose it was the 14th.
"But Carver was in the Arahura Valley that very same night."
Lerventhal looked up sharply.
"Who told you that?" "A Maori fellow. Tave something his name is. Youngish chap. Wears a big green pendant. I spoke with him in the street this morning."
"What is his authority?"
Balfour explained that Te Rau Taufari and Crosby Wells had been great friends, and that Taufari had observed Francis Carver entering the cottage on the day of the hermit's death. As to whether Carver had been present in the cottage before or after Wells' death, Balfour did not know, but Taufari had assured him that Carver's arrival had occurred before Lauderback's, and Lauderback, by his own testimony, had arrived at the cottage not long after the event of the hermit's death, for when he entered, the man's kettle had been boiling on the range and had not yet run dry. It stood to reason, therefore, that Francis Carver had been present in the cottage before Crosby Wells passed away, and perhaps, Balfour realized with a chill, had even witnessed his death. Lerventhal stroked his moustache.
"This is very interesting news," he said. "Godspeed sailed late that evening, well after sundown, so Carver must have come straight back to Hokitika from the Arahura Valley, made his way directly for the ship, and weighed anchor all before the dawn. That is a very hasty departure, I think."
"Rum to my eye," said Balfour,
He was thinking about his vanished shipping crate.
And when one considers that Staines disappeared around the very same time...
And Anna, said Balfour, cutting across him. That was the night of her collapse, because Lorneback found her, you remember, in the road.
Ah, said Lerventhal, another coincidence.
You might say only a weak mind puts faith in coincidence, said Balfour, but I say, a string of coincidences cannot be a coincidence. A string of them?
No, indeed, said Lerventhal distantly.
Presently Balfour said, But young Staines, that's a perfect shame, that is. There's no use being soft about it, Ben. He's been murdered, surely. A man doesn't vanish. A poor man, maybe, but not a man of means.
Said Lerventhal, who was not thinking about Staines. I wonder what Carver was doing with Wells in the Arahura, and what he was running away from, for that matter, or running towards.
The editor thought a moment more and then exclaimed, I say, Lauderback's not mixed up with Carver, is he?
Balfour expelled a long breath.
Well, that's the real question, he said, with a show of great reluctance. But I'd be breaking Lauderback's confidence if I told you. I'd be breaking my word.
He looked again at the wick of the candle, hoping that his friend would prompt him to continue. Unhappily for Balfour, however, Lerventhal's moral code did not accept the kind of violation that Balfour was proposing he indulge. After studying Balfour dispassionately for a moment, he sat back in his chair and changed the subject.
"Do you know," he said, speaking in a brisker tone, "you are not the first man to come by my office and ask me about that notice in the paper, the one about Emery Staines?"
Balfour looked up, both disappointed and surprised.
"Why? Who else?"
"A man came by in the middle of the week. Wednesday. Well, perhaps it was Tuesday. Irish. A clergyman by profession, but not a Catholic. He was a Methodist, I think. He used to be the chaplain of the new jail."
"Free Methodist," Balfour said. "I met him this morning. Strange-looking. Very unfortunate teeth. What was his interest on account of—"
"But I can't remember his name," Lerventhal murmured, tapping his lip.
"Why was he interested in Staines?" Balfour asked again, for he did not know the chaplain's name and could not offer it.
Lerventhal folded his hands together again on the tabletop.
"Well, it was rather odd," he said.